This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 9th of February 2013 on Monocle 24.
A pair of Kiwi magazine men with some views on the state of their country's newsstand, a tower of Southern Hemisphere titles, and a fathering publication that won't make you groan. Slip on your jandals for this 24th edition of The Stack, today from Auckland. Coming up on the program today, we'll also be jumping across the Pacific to sample a new approach to parenting publishing, not surprisingly, out of Brooklyn.
Really, there was truly kind of like a hole in the marketplace, which is very rare in this day and age.
And our Kiwi guests will have some rather candid views on some of their homegrown titles.
I'd describe it as a cross between Wallpaper and Tatler, which sounds pretentious, and that's because Denizen is a little bit pretentious.
All that and a few more reading tips today from Auckland here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to this very special edition of The Stack. I'm Tyler Brulé. Today we're coming to you from the heart of Auckland, a city that's in the midst of a serious bit of reinvention as it defines its role not only in the Asia-Pacific region, but also globally. With a tiny population that punches well above its weight in a variety of sectors beyond sport, today we're about to meet two magazine men who'll tell us about the state of the market, and I'm hoping they'll be able to get through the next 55 minutes without using the word hobbits. And joining us around the table here on The Stack is John Baker, who is the publisher of Tangible Media here in New Zealand. The company's titles cover everything from marketing, food, lifestyle, and sport. John is also the chair of the Magazine Publishers Association in New Zealand. John, welcome.
Thank you.
I wanted to start, of course, every week on the program, we talk about the state of media around the world. But also, I think we try to make a point that it's, you know, all things are not equal in all corners of the world either. It's a very unique market, given the scale and size. You know, New Zealand, geographically reasonably large, but also a total population not unlike that of many major cities around the world as well. So what does that mean for print media here?
I think there's a double-edged sword. I think we lack the scale that many markets have got, which enables us to specialise. And I think specialisation is where media has got its future. So that's a bit tricky. But at the same time, I think we've been protected somewhat by some of the other trends that have happened globally because of that distance. So I think to a large extent, we haven't been threatened so much by digital media just yet. So we've had a bit of a heads up that the rest of the world didn't enjoy, I think.
I want to come back to probably the whole notion of maybe how one stays slightly insulated in this market, I guess as a big player and also as a small player as well. Our other guest joining us here in studio today is Andy Pickering, the creative director of Pilot Magazine, which is now in its sixth issue and contains a diverse mix of big ideas, strong photography, and rather handsome design. But you've also got, can we call it a day job as well, or another gig beside also doing Pilot?
Yes, I guess I have a day job in that I also write a newspaper column. I don't want to call it a gossip column, but essentially it is that. And I do a few writing gigs on the site.
You can name the source. Who are you writing for your column?
I write for the Herald on Sunday.
Okay. Excellent. I want to go back to the point, though, John, earlier. The last time we were in a Commonwealth country, I mean, aside from home base in the UK, we were in Toronto. And it's interesting looking at the state of Canadian media, for example, when you've got, you know, the beast of the United States, 10 times the population of Canada next door, that if you look in most Canadian magazines, you see that not every title, but many titles get some type of support in Canada from the federal government. And you'll sort of see the maple leaf mark. Now, if I look through magazines here, will I see a little Kiwi? You know, is the government involved also culturally to really sustain print and also, you know, New Zealand thinking, as it were?
Not at all. The industry gets no government support whatsoever. I mean, there are government bodies that support the creative arts in New Zealand, Creative New Zealand. You have New Zealand On Air that supports broadcast media in New Zealand. And it's something of an irritation to us in print media that the government doesn't see the value in supporting print media in quite the same way. I think partly we've been victims of our own success because we've been able to support our creative talents and creative outputs ourselves up until sort of quite recently. I think there's been a sense that there's been no need for that support. But I think in terms of telling sort of cultural stories, I think that we are probably leading the way now in achieving that.
Andy, would you agree? I mean, six issues into Pilot now, and we'll talk a little bit about, or maybe at considerable length, we'll talk about what Pilot does. But as an independent publisher, does that chime with you?
Yes, it does. It'd be nice to have some government support. And as John says, there are various grants and industries out there, but it's not like you can just go with your hand out and someone's saying, look, here's some money and we'll invest this into your magazine and you're doing a great job and supporting New Zealand culture. It's just not like that.
I mean, I think probably many people listening would say it would just be absolutely horrendous to have the hand of government involved. And if you're going to be, a business in a modern world, then you should be self-sustaining. But John, to your point, do you think it's not a particularly level playing field? If anyone is in the arts, then why aren't they at least helping with startups? Maybe titles which are, of course, of bigger scale, perhaps don't need government support. But if you're a young indie and you want to get something up and running in the suburbs of Wellington, then maybe you should be able to go and talk to the federal government.
Yeah, I think it's the level playing field thing which is the irritation for me. From a personal point of view, I don't seek government support. I want our media properties to be successful in their own right. But I do believe that there is a hollowed out of our creative community with respect to photography and writing and design, which I think the government could support. And I think often those smaller publishers are the incubator for that talent. So I just think there isn't a level playing field. And when we see, it won't mean anything to you, Tyler, but we see large amounts of taxpayer money going to a television program, which is pretty much a reality TV show set in the Gold Coast. I kind of question the decision making that's at government level around where that money's going.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
does this make it into your column, maybe, or?
Well, I do know the reality TV show in question, and I tend to agree with that. There is a lot of money invested into local TV, whereas publishing not so much. But funnily enough, the British Council, which I'm sure you are aware of, and the British Council have been going for a long time, and they have offices all around the world, and they have an office here in Auckland, and when we first started Pilot, I knew someone who was a representative of the British Council here, and they actually did help us out just a little bit. And the reason they did that is because they could see that we were supporting not only local New Zealand creatives, but also creatives from around the world, including several from Britain. And so the British Council found a link there, and they entered into a little partnership with us, which was, it was nice.
John, tell me about the state of the magazine reader in this country right now, because one of the markets where we see extraordinary growth, and I don't want to lump everyone in together here, I might get punched in the studio, but everyone talks about Australia as being, really one of the markets where magazines have always sustained themselves. It's always been a great market, perhaps because of geography and maybe not unlike this place. So I can sort of speak on a very personal level. Our growth for Monocle in Australia is absolutely huge. This market, it doesn't sort of register in numbers, but in percentage terms, it's also incredibly strong as well. So do you think, would you say that the state of the newsstand, I was at Magnation before, yesterday and today, before we went on air, looking at that, and also looking at some of the more, chain operators here as well. It seems, pretty healthy, again, given the size of the market. There's a lot of homegrown titles, both indie, but certainly, on the commercial scale as well. Now, they might be in the hands of international owners, but nevertheless, they're certainly covering the New Zealand patch. How do you see, the state of newsstand here at the moment?
Newsstand's really healthy. I mean, I think we've seen a reduction in the mass market weeklies over a 10-year period. The gossip column type magazines have decreased. The sort of specialist area, the sort of high value area, we've seen an increase in sales in many cases, and and also an increase in subscription. So I think when we talk about newsstand, we think about paid content. We've definitely seen a sort of a migration from retail into subscription, which I think is a really positive thing in terms of the engagement with an audience. And that's been largely driven by, I think, the retailers looking for more profitable products to run off their stands. And I think that's a characteristic that's common in the UK as well and other markets. But the actual paid-for media proposition is very strong in this country, and magazines are very, very strong in this country. Where the kind of the pressure point is for us as a business in the advertising market, that's where we've felt the most pain.
Right. Well, which is a bit of an international story. We're going to come back and talk about Pilot in a moment, but I thought we would jump to the other side of the world and look at something which is certainly a growth area in some sectors. Parenting magazines can sometimes elicit groans from print lovers, but a new title from Brooklyn has done away with the saccharine photography and naff headlines to completely reinvent the genre. It's called Kindling Quarterly, and our associate editor, Barrett Austin, spoke with the editor, David Michael Perez.
Exploration of fatherhood is meant to differentiate it from, because I think I found that if I say it's a magazine about fatherhood, sometimes people think, oh, well, it's just for fathers, or it's a how-to, or it's like a guide. And it's really not, that's not our kind of primary focus. We definitely hope that it's inspiring and, you know, enlightening and informative, but it's not a kind of how to be a dad. There's a lot of great resources online, and there's, you know, a lot of great books that kind of cover that territory. It's a little bit more broad than that. It's an exploration of sort of fatherhood and the kind of what it means. And in that sense, we hope that it's interesting to people who aren't just fathers. It's, you know, interesting to people who think about sort of issues of sort of community and parenting in general and, you know, gender dynamics and masculinity.
Just looking at it, it seems like it's very much sort of a niche type publication. It covers a wide range of topics. But what was it that led you to launch a magazine like this covering these sort of topics?
My wife and I just had our first son. His name is Eamon. He just turned 6 months last week, actually a week ago. And I think in the kind of the lead up to his birth, I had just been thinking a lot about becoming a parent and all the kind of anxiety that accompanies that. And it really struck me that there wasn't anything out there that was kind of thoughtfully addressing dads or fatherhood issues around that, whether they be kind of the big issues or sort of the small issues. Really, there was truly kind of like a hole in the marketplace, which is very rare in this day and age, there not be something out there that's similar. So, you know, just from a purely kind of like a business perspective, it seemed like something that really needed to exist. And almost, I was just so surprised that something like it didn't exist or hadn't been around since like the 60s or 70s. You know, to that end, it felt very important that it be kind of a print magazine, that it kind of be in the world since it hasn't really been covered before.
We've got copies of the inaugural issue here right in front of us. Why don't you just sort of flip through some of the pages and talk about some of the stories that are covered? What would we read if we were to open Kindling Quarterly?
Kindling Quarterly issue one, it runs the gamut in terms of the kind of geographic locations, but we really tried to maintain a somewhat simple approach to our subjects. It's a lot of sort of stories about kind of creative individuals who are kind of fathers who maybe they're new fathers, maybe they've been fathers for, you know, a handful of years. Most of them are younger, but, you know, there's several interviews, there's a few short stories, there's recipes, there's photo essays. In terms of each sort of person that we cover, whether they are an artist or whether they are a designer or kind of a cook, we try to kind of focus on sort of their life as a whole and how fatherhood or parenting kind of relates to that, not just reducing them to just being a dad, per se.
Looking at the magazine, there's a very impressive sense of artistic direction to it. Obviously, the graphics, sort of the aesthetics, that was something that I assume was quite prominent on your mind when it came to putting this magazine together. Tell me about your background. Tell me about the background of your sort of partner in the magazine and sort of how that helped this come about, artistically speaking.
So my role, as I mentioned, is kind of publisher slash editor, and my background is kind of writing, both kind of academic background and sort of research. So I'm sort of handling the more editorial vision of the project, But my business partner is August Hefner, who's a very talented graphic designer, and he's actually a design director. We're good friends, and you know, we just started talking about the magazine together, and it, you know, it's been a very, very good partnership in the sense that we both kind of complement each other and, you know, kind of respect each other and handle sort of different aspects. He is the one that should take all the credit for its beautiful design, because I really, you know, I trusted him 100% to know that he would really make it absolutely beautiful and very thoughtful, and people have really responded to the designs.
And unsurprisingly, a magazine that focuses on the issue of fatherhood is appealing to fathers. But you also mentioned that it's not something that you hope to pigeonhole and only sell this magazine to fathers. What are the other sort of demographics, if any, specifically, does this magazine cater toward? Who do you hope ends up picking up copies of Kindling Quarterly?
You know, that's a great question. And when you start any kind of project or any kind of business venture, I think often people mistakenly think, oh, this is for everybody, especially like with an issue like fatherhood. It's so broad, it's very tempting to think that. And it becomes really clear as you start putting it together that, no, this isn't for everybody. Like, we do have sort of a specific sort of aesthetic that will appeal to specific people. In terms of our demographics, it's, you know, we don't have kind of hard numbers or hard facts about sort of backgrounds. But, you know, in terms of the gender response, it's definitely been purchases from women, either as gifts or just a lot of, you know, kind of like a lot of interest from a lot of women. Either it's for subscriptions for men or so on and so forth. But, you know, in terms of who Kindling appeals to, I really think it's kind of any person who's really thinking about fatherhood, but who's thinking about ways in which to kind of build their life around their kid. And Kindling is like my personal way of doing that. But I think it's actually the story of each kind of issue or each story is how men sort of creatively take on the project of fatherhood and how it kind of reshapes all aspects of their life.
The first issue has only just come out, and it's only just now being distributed across the country and I assume eventually across the world. Mm-hmm. It's a quarterly magazine. Are you already thinking about issue two?
Yeah, we're actually a little behind on issue two. We're talking to people now and sort of putting stories together, so we're working on it. Yeah, I'm really excited. I mean, honestly, I am so excited about issue one, but it's kind of that thing where you look at it and you just think about issue two. I feel so positive about issue one, but I'm really excited about all the changes that it'll come and how it will evolve over time.
That was Monocle's Barrett Austin speaking with the editor of Kindling Quarterly, David Michael Perez. Just before we go for a very short break, interesting sort of listening to a magazine which is incredibly niche. One of the amazing things I found in this country is, given sort of the remote nature of this nation, you know, Kiwis have just by nature have had to become incredibly good at just doing many things because it's rather far if you want to get something, you know, specialized done in Japan or somewhere else. And one point of that, I was out on Great Barrier Island last year, and I was renting a house. Someone was very generous to actually lend me their house, but I couldn't believe the exquisite precision of this kitchen and the stainless steel work. And I said, explain to me, how did this happen? And, you know, where was it shipped in from? And someone said, you know, part of this, if you want a great kitchen, it's actually one of the easiest things to do in New Zealand because of the yacht building industry. And the yacht building industry, you know, in part is because, you know, shipbuilding, remoteness, all of those types of things. I want to ask you both, just before we go to break, do you also find that whether it comes to, you know, working with a repro company, when it comes to, dealing with, paper traders, et cetera, do you find there's that sort of level of speciality in this country because of your remote nature? And John, to you first.
I don't think there's any lack of skill in any element of our business, and certainly no lack of passion for it. And I think, about printing as an example. I mean, one of the things that characterizes our business is we're part of a group which is called the Image Centre Group, which actually owns, apart from anything else, its own printing presses. So we work day to day with the guys who run the machines, and largely they're immigrants. They've come from the UK and other places. So they actually bring these kind of international capabilities and commitments. And so I think New Zealand is this kind of amalgam of immigrants with varying talents, whether it be in food or printing, whatever it might be. I think that's one of our characteristics, I think.
Andy, what's your experience?
Yes, I mean, from a personal perspective, as the creative director of Pilot, you know, I do a little bit of everything. So I'll write a lot of the magazine, I'll source a lot of the imagery, commission a lot of the imagery, shoot some, and, you know, get quite pedantic over the typography and design. And I guess in New Zealand we call it number 8 wire mentality. Have you heard that expression?
No, explain it.
So it just means that... you know, you can make something out of nothing, so you or use a piece of wire to fix something. So that's how we explain it here.
No, and I think you see it in so many corners, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it more as the stack continues. Our special edition from Auckland here on Monocle 24, going away for a very short break. We're back in a moment.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we send Katie to Cannes to catch up with the music industry's movers and shakers, visit Miami to see what kind of TV the big boys are buying, and get down to a seriously freestyle Midori House session from jazz hip-hop maestro Soweto Kinch, who talks a good game too.
A particular kind of energy sparks happen between an audience and you while you're freestyling. You can't deny that it's some kind of spiritual energy that moves, that makes it work or not work sometimes.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé, and we are in Auckland today for a very special edition, part of our APAC tour. We're going to be coming to you from Sydney next week. We're also going to be in Singapore and Hong Kong. Not quite sure if we're going to be doing programs from those venues, but nevertheless, here we are on the North Island of New Zealand, and I'm joined by John Baker and Andy Pickering. Andy Pickering is the creative director of Pilot magazine, and I thought I would give you, this is your platform and stage, to take us through the pages, Andy. Tell, you know, not, I think really good to know the gap that, of course, you spotted in the market and what you're looking to deliver, and this being your sixth issue right now.
What with Pilot, I used to be the editor of another magazine called Remix, which was music and fashion orientated, and I enjoyed doing that. But over my time there, I developed my own ideas on what I thought a really good magazine with little to no compromise or holding back could be about. And I wanted it to express a very strong design-led visual aesthetic. But I also wanted to just try and break away from being pigeonholed into being a magazine that was about fashion or about design or whatever it was. So while there ended up being, there's quite a large fashion, art and design content, I also slowly brought in a little bit of a, I guess the easy way to describe it is a scientific viewpoint. Myself, I'm quite interested in popular science and new technology and the kind of technology transformations that are, you know, on the cusp of transforming our world. So just by playing around with those kind of ideas and then presenting them in quite a playful way through the power of graphic design and unique and different visuals, we hopefully give the reader a different kind of experience.
It's interesting how you talk about science as opposed to using, you know, the D word and talking about digital, or that, you know, using sort of the big T of technology, which is often, you know, what has to, you know, not what doesn't have to, but I think a lot of people sort of see that as, you know, things that are almost need to be a constant today as part of the dialogue. But maybe explain to us then, how does that sort of notion of science manifest itself in the pages?
Okay, so in the issue that you're flicking through at the moment, there's a 32-page feature in that issue which is on the subject of the singularity. I'm sure you know what the singularity idea is. So to nutshell it, the idea is by the year 2045, the exponential power of computing increases to the point where artificial intelligence is smarter than the human brain. So it's kind of a really out there idea, but it's from a science fiction perspective, it's really fascinating. So essentially, we tried to explore that idea through 32 pages using a whole bunch of different illustrations and photography, and just try and tie
and also a lot of copy.
Yes,
as well, which I think is interesting. You know, not that of course, you know, magazines, which and I should say, with when you look at Pilot, it's an incredibly large format, slightly larger than I think is perhaps the fashion elsewhere, and I think that has a lot to do with cost in other parts of the world. But also that this is a wonderful, glossy title, and wonderful paperweight. Also, you're then mixing matte stock at the same time, but. There's of course a series of page after page of arresting images, but it's quite unusual to see quite academic looking text. So I want to just go back to that. You know, when you're talking about this notion of singularity, the tension that you're creating between sort of words and imagery and commissioned images, both photographic and also illustrations as well. What do you want the reader to walk away with?
We want the reader to walk away with...
Well, hopefully purchasing the magazine, obviously, yes. More than anything else. But
you know, as you know, there are so many magazine titles around the world, and so many of them follow a very rigid formula. And, you know, fair enough, you know, it's a commercial formula and you have to do what works. But being given the opportunity to start a magazine myself and do what I wanted to do. I didn't want to do something that had already been done. So we really just followed our hearts and decided to do a magazine that we thought would appeal to us, and Pilot is the result. So there's no escaping the fact that it is very much a niche magazine, and there are a lot of challenges that come with being a niche magazine in a tiny little niche market like New Zealand. But we'd like the reader to come away from it thinking, wow, this is a really special, unusual magazine, and hopefully I've learnt something, and hopefully this is a magazine that I want to keep hold of in a physical format.
There are many magazines gathered around the table too, which I've also brought some in, and we'll be talking about those after the break. You're listening to The Stack. We're in Auckland. We're back in a moment.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London, and New York.
You're back with The Stack with a very special edition coming to you from Auckland here on Monocle 24. We're talking to John Baker, the chair of the Magazine Publishers Association here in New Zealand, also has a day job too, I guess, in the form of also being with Tangible Media, and Andy Pickering, the creative director of Pilot Magazine. I've just before we talk about the things that you guys have brought in, I went to the newsstand, and I don't want to quite do flashcards, but I brought a few things in, which seem to be somewhat front and center when I went into Magnation in Ponsonby. So I'm just going to, you know, for anyone listening, maybe sort of your response to what these titles do. Now, I've got a copy of New Zealand Listener in front of me. Looks like, of course, a news title, headline, Startling Study Fertility Food, Professor Wayne Cutfield's Advice on What to Eat for Conception and a Healthy Baby. Gentlemen, where does this magazine sit on the newsstand? Andy, looks like you want to answer first.
Well, the funny thing about this title is, and I guess this goes to show the population size of a country like New Zealand and the 2 degrees of separation, which can be illustrated by the fact that my best friend and writing partner, that's actually his niece on the cover of the magazine.
That baby,
yes, right. And I held that baby in my arms not 1 week ago. The title itself is... It's been around forever. It's the kind of magazine that everyone's father gets. Has TV and radio listings and some pretty good politics coverage. I think it's a general, very strong general New Zealand current affairs and entertainment weekly.
Now, aside from the fact that it's got TV listings in the back, we've seen, of course, you know, one of the world's most famous news weeklies recently only go digital in the form of Newsweek. But does a title like this actually have a stronger chance in a domestic market where it can be part of the conversation, doesn't have to worry about the entire world as it's patched? John, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the Listener, you know, it's a bit of an icon in New Zealand magazine publishing. You know, and I think a lot of households receive it because, you know, they've received it for generations almost, you know, and I think it's probably, you know, I'd describe it as kind of the intellectual weekly, I suppose, you know, in terms of its attempt to sort of treat issues more intelligently than your Women's Weekly type titles would, you know, and with a sort of a socially liberal filter, you know, I think in that regard. You know, I think that it's once again been a title that's managed to maintain its paid circulation numbers really well against the sort of this barrage of competition from digital media and commentators.
Now, I picked up a title called Mind Food. It was sitting beside The Spectator. It was sitting beside Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, etc. Mind Food, subline on it is smart thinking, and there's a gentleman sitting on a Vespa with an apple crate on the back, and he's got two doggies, and it's Al Brown. It says, exclusive interview, meet our new columnist Al Brown on his big move and future plans, plus his favorite seafood recipes. I mean, that's quite a tall order for any title. John, to you, where does this fit in into the newsstand in this country?
Yeah, well, Mind Food's your classic Women's Lifestyle Monthly, and Michael McHugh, who launched the magazine, has got a fairly strong history in publishing both sides of the Tasman. And I think what really defined Mind Food right from day one was Michael's vision about it being a sort of multi-channel media property from the beginning, whereas many of us are retrofitting that into our strategy, if you like, right now, you know, and perhaps not dissimilar to your thinking for Monocle, but he's been really successful in...
So he has been successful at actually creating a total series of properties.
He really has. He's probably it's certainly the best New Zealand example of a media property migrating from print into, you know, into digital broadcast, into radio, into brand extensions, into events, you know, and I think he's to be congratulated for what he's achieved. Mm.
I've got a copy of Home magazine in front of me, which seems to have a very large promotional budget, at least for their art issue, because I popped into a number of newsstands and they seem to have bought up lots of space for this issue in terms of at least a point of purchase display. Andy, feel weighing in on this one.
Yes, Home is, I think they're a relatively new magazine, or they relaunched. Funnily enough, the Home is designed by the same team who do Pilot. I don't think it's as nice
You're
looking as Pilot.
You're making this country small. Sounds smaller by the moment. So,
I think they've got some way to go. You can see it's still a relatively thin magazine, but you know that's indicative of the market, I guess, that they're operating in. But, you know, it looks good and it serves a purpose. I think they have potential.
It's published by Bauer, so I guess was this part of ACP before?
That's correct, yeah.
And they've well and truly I guess, I don't know if the ACP name is going, you know, for people who don't know, it was Australian Consolidated Press, who have long been big players in this part of the world.
Yeah, that's right. It's now Bauer Media.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, we're all getting used to that.
The Germans are in town.
The Germans are definitely in town, yeah.
Very much. I have to say that this morning at the hotel I was staying at, a very large German cruise ship came into harbor, and it's quite funny because the hotel, they actually... they said they put a little note on your pillow saying you might want to close your drapes because a large ship will be coming in overnight. But they don't tell they didn't tell the German passengers to do that. So of course, when you looked out of your window this morning at only sort of 10 feet away, you really saw the full Germany.
Yeah.
We'll leave it at that.
Can I make a point about home?
Of course,
actually,
yes.
just quickly, I've got a very soft spot for this magazine. When I first started the magazines in 1992, I worked on Home and Building magazine, which later was sold to ACP Media and became...
And then evolved into this.
Yeah, so I have got a 21 years relationship.
But this they're really pushing the redesign on this now, because...
Oh, there's been several incarnations of that. I mean, I think what's been interesting with that, you mentioned Urbis magazine earlier, that this sort of battle for the sort of high design kind of architectural magazine from a consumer perspective, I think it's probably fair to say that Home's winning that battle out in the market.
Just two more before we go. Denizen seems to, from my point of view, they like their party pages of the magazine. There's a fair degree of high-end advertising trying to be the Vanity Fair of this country, what would you say?
I'd describe it as a cross between Wallpaper and Tatler. Which sounds pretentious, and that's because Denizen is a little bit pretentious, but they do what they do very well. They have a real lock on the kind of higher-end hospo and kind of fashion and party lifestyle, and they do that very well.
Right. Any other views on that, John?
I describe it as vacuous.
Right. Oh, okay. Now, just before we go,
Andy's being generous.
He is. I thought there might be sort of a few views on that. And this is something which is not homegrown, but that certainly the content. Aortica magazine from Germany, which is an international magazine about local Schöpfungskraft and hardworking squirrels. That is the subtitle of the magazine. But a whole issue which they've done on Auckland, which I'm sure both of you have probably seen that. At a handsome $39 that they can charge for that, I say, good for them if they can do it. And actually, very sweetly, again, how small is this town? We went into Magnation, and I went to buy it, and the woman said, "Oh, in fact, there's a signed copy for you." The editor had actually left a sealed copy. I was like, how they knew I was coming to town? Who knows? But anyway, an interesting expression nonetheless. Okay. Who am I going to put on the spot first? Andy, what do you want to talk about? What titles have you brought in? Other than a stack of your own, which we talked about, you can, of course, look at that. But is there anything else in the mix as well that you wanted to chat about what you like?
You've probably seen Mark magazine.
Yes, absolutely.
So where is Mark from?
I believe, you're putting me on the spot, but I think Mark is Dutch, I'm not mistaken. Yes, Lander Hesperiden 68, it is indeed, it's a Dutch magazine. Looking at all of the names, yes, it's definitely Dutch.
So it's obviously a very, very strong architecture magazine, and I think they've brought a really fresh sense of design and photography to that genre, and I really enjoy flicking through the pages, and I think that issue there is a number of years old, but it still looks super, super fresh.
I mean, that's one thing that stands out when you're at the newsstand, are just the sheer number of architecture magazines. Now, okay, I went to some specialist shops, but there's a real maybe for some I guess from an outside perspective, I think oftentimes people look at New Zealand and they think of, they think of a smaller UK at the bottom of the Pacific. They think of it as being sort of a lovely twee country and lots of farmhouses. Yet what's so different, even when you actually look at just, I think even some of the more mass pedestrian home magazines, is how much of a modernist design aesthetic there is. I mean, yes, you can get your country curtains and your ginghams and all of that's one part of the newsstand in this country. But nevertheless, when you look at mass titles, you're really surprised how much modern architecture is. There's also an aspiration to build a modern house, not to actually try to build a Mediterranean villa or try to build a Cotswolds cottage. Is that, I don't know if that's fair or not, but that's just the outsider's observation coming down here. And I don't know what you Is that true-ish?
I think that's true-ish, definitely. I think just being such a small country and exposed to the rest of the world, so we take our influences from everywhere, and you know, slowly but surely, we're building a stronger and stronger New Zealand identity and expressing ourselves as such. But fair.
Okay, that's good. John, you've got the new scientist there. I don't know if you want to start with the new scientist or. I know you mentioned Dish, you put that at the bottom, but you can, but yeah, anyway, New Scientist is as part of your regular reading diet?
Well, it's I brought it because I admire it, and it's part of my son's regular reading diet, and I think it's one of the, I guess the points I'd like to make. I've got a 16-year-old son who lives online, does a lot of gaming, he's a really bright boy, and I give him New Scientist every week, and he stops and reads it and immerses himself in that title. And
so you're not force feeding him, John.
I'm not force feeding him, no. But and I think that the I mean he loves science, and I mean I think it was interesting hearing Andy talk about the role of science in Pilot, and I think scientists are the coolest people on the planet, you know. And what I like about New Scientist is how it delivers quite complex ideas from a technology and from a science perspective, but delivers it in a way which is so compelling and so interesting. You know, I grew up reading Kurt Vonnegut and Isaac Asimov and those kind of science fiction writers. So I guess that's part of the buzz for me. But you know, I also, one of the things I really hate in publishing is pretentiousness. We've talked about that earlier, and I think that of all the people in the world who probably deserve to be pretentious, it would be scientists. But when you talk to them, they're just not, you know. And I love that.
Tell me the reading habits of your son, and you know, we come up against this all the time that you go and talk to an advertiser or you meet people who have views about media, and they'll say, oh yeah, but of course, you know, young generation is only living online. They're not looking at print anymore. At least, you know, our experiences, yeah, we often refer to this sort of this post magazine generation. That in fact, yeah, maybe they were weaned on, you know, a diet of, you know, of which is, you know, largely sort of, you know, video and everything digital that goes with that. But yet, there's that sense of discovery of print as well. And I wonder, John, if you see that within your own son, but also even when you're talking to other publishers within your organization.
Absolutely. I think people who make that comment are making it out of a vested interest. Usually that commentary comes from digital media owners. And so, you know, I think we've sort of allowed...
Or print publishers who are moving to digital.
Well, I think the things aren't, they're not mutually exclusive, are they?
No.
Right. You know, and I think that's the thing. They're incredibly complementary mediums. And so... I know. We have a business full of people in their early 20s who have graduated from journalism school, and I interviewed one this morning, and they certainly don't perceive a world which the physical manifestation of our products come to an end. You know, quite the contrary. I reject it, you know, completely.
Good. And we support you in that. You're listening to The Stack. The special edition is coming to you from Auckland today. We're going away for a very short break.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're back with The Stack here in Auckland. Gentlemen, we have maybe another 7 or 8 minutes to go before we have to say goodbye from New Zealand. But John, I want to go back to you, though. You mentioned Dish a little bit earlier. We were talking about, you know, just seeing New Zealand titles elsewhere on the newsstand. Yes, the interest of full disclosure. It is related or is part of the family of your company.
Yes, it is.
As well. It's amazing looking at, and of course, you know, people talk about, you know, the boom that's occurred with just, you know, Aussie lifestyle and Aussie chefs. However, you know, I think a lot of people have maybe bundled the accent, you know, in there by mistake. And there's, you know, certainly there's probably a very healthy debate as to, you know, where did the coffee boom really come from? Did it come from these islands, or did it come from the bigger continent across the way? The culinary boom that has occurred, you know, in this market, you know, is it something really of sort of the last two decades and then all of the publishing that goes with it? I couldn't believe it. I was in a bookstore the other day. The amount of homegrown, I mean, really domestic, beautifully produced cookbooks is just remarkable.
Yeah.
And can you actually sort of mark a starting point? Can you actually sort of see, you know, when this happened and you know, why? Was it because, you know, Peter Gordon went off to London, or what happened?
I don't pretend to be a historian on that, and I think there was I think certainly from a pioneering perspective, Cuisine was the magazine that sort of led that charge. You know, when Julie Dalzell really took that magazine into took food into a mass market for the first time, and I think in many respects the rest of us have kind of sailed on her bow wave a little bit as far as that's concerned. But I think it's really about the fact that this country creates just such great ingredients. And as we've had, as I mentioned earlier, the sort of migration of people from all parts of the world who have brought different craft into this country. I think one of those key crafts has been the ability to grow and produce different food. And that's inspired a whole kind of genre of New Zealandness, which is this fusion of a whole bunch of international things together. And I think it's just a really exciting place to be in food. And if you speak to anybody who comes here, it's the flavour of the ingredients and the freshness of the ingredients is the thing that gets them. And that's also the case in our wine and more recently in our craft beer category, which is really exploding at the moment too. So
yeah, that's actually been fascinating. We were talking to someone from local government here they talk about the real emphasis on the beverage business. And you think, okay, well, fine, you're just talking about vineyards, even, you know, this was talked about within the Auckland region or this part of the North Island. Like, no, they said, you know, whether it's juices, you know, whether it's, you know, developing syrups for new types of sodas, as much as, you know, developing more mineral waters, this is something that New Zealand, you know, really feels that they can bring, you know, to the world. I wonder how much, as an industry and on the publishing side, are you sort of in lockstep with that? Because sometimes when you are, you know, a smaller country as well, there is often a very sort of healthy dialogue between small business organizations like yours, John. Do you feel that there is not pressure, but sort of a need to sort of, you know, reflect that in a way?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think we have a responsibility to kind of any kind of niche or specialist title, I think, has a responsibility to represent the interests of the trade, if you like. So I think that is important, whether in this particular case, be it growers or restaurateurs or winemakers or whoever it might be. And I think we see a part that we can play with a product like Dish in supporting the whole international perspective of New Zealand food and wine. And so I think that's something that we do take very seriously.
Where did you guys see an opportunity in the marketplace? I mean, to pitch Dish, that, you know, where could you come in a different way against a very established title like Cuisine, do you think?
Yeah, well, it was a few years ago now. It was 2004 that we launched the magazine, so it's 8 years ago. I think that part of the opportunity for us was that we wanted an emphasis to be on the food. Cuisine was very much, I think there was a equality between the food and wine.
Right.
We wanted the food to be the hero. And we wanted food to be something, we wanted our readers to actually cook from the magazine. So I think in terms of accessibility, we're probably more accessible from a food perspective,
right,
just from the recipes themselves. You know, that's a perspective which Cuisine might argue with, but
right,
the point is that's where we wanted a magazine for cooks.
Mm.
And we wanted a magazine that, whilst beautiful, and I think there's no unquestionably it is a beautiful magazine, once again, is not pretentious. You know, it's down to earth. It's engaging.
The
ingredients are great. You know, you can make it, and it looks terrific.
Yeah, and I think also probably for, you know, of course, a lot of our reviewers bring on food titles, and I think what's, you know, interesting about this, I would say sort of over the last, you know, 10 shows, 15 shows, you know, a lot of it has been, you know, very, you know, niche titles, the likes of Cereal, the likes of Kinfolk, et cetera, which are, you know, some would argue are probably a little bit pretentious and a little bit precious in nature. So for those who haven't seen Dish, I mean, this is obviously something which is wants to be there for the long haul. And, you know, as you said, it's been around since 2004, so it must be doing something right. Andy, we probably have time for one more title. I mean, you've got Man About Town, and then you also have, Common Sense as well. You chucked one on the floor, so...
Commons and Sense, it's a magazine out of Tokyo. It's a, you know, it's a style mag or a fashion magazine, but it's one that really impressed me for a long time because the sheer commitment to beautiful fashion porn or beauty porn is just unrelenting, and the photography is just outstanding and out of this world. I especially like the way they treat accessories. So you've got, you know, beautiful boots, and they just give page after page to full size handbag shots, right, or shoe shots.
And there's sort of an epic element about it. I'm trying to decode this slightly, but I think also you like this when you sort of reference with Pilot that there's a scientific approach, that there is almost something molecular when I'm actually, this particular story that you're going through. I mean, it is really, you know, still life, you know, writ large, which is quite something.
Yeah, I think, you know, you don't see, most magazines don't have the pages to just say, hey, we're going to do 40 pages of beautifully shot, lush handbag shots. But I think if for a magazine like Commons and Sense, who have the commitment to do that, and they do an outstanding job of it.
Yeah.
And so from a fashion consumer's point of view, that's, you know, gives you an opportunity to get really up close and personal with the products.
Gentlemen, just before we go, sort of, you know, thoughts and reflections on the marketplace. I mean, it's interesting that you're both, you know, pretty buoyant about things. John, you know, focus of your organization, though, I mean, right now, when you talk to other publishers, the state of the market, you know, is it about being able to, for people to build these brands internationally to sort of, you know, gain 10, 15, 20% growth either by going to Australia or hoping to, you know, do licensed editions, you know, elsewhere, you know, within Asia, to do Singapore, Hong Kong editions? What would you say is sort of the focus down here when you talk to publishers?
Well, I think from a domestic market point of view, as I mentioned earlier, the sort of the pressure point right now is ad revenue. So organizationally, we're trying to kind of articulate a view which I guess makes advertisers and agencies fall back in love with magazines. I think we've done a pretty poor job collectively at that, and that's what we're trying to address. And I think there are many opportunities for us to do that. And I think the very definition of what is a magazine has to be reconsidered as well. And I think it is this kind of multi-channel beast. But at the heart of it, there's the physical brand. You know, I think the other thing is we want to separate ourselves from newspapers. We don't want to be lumped into the print media.
Right.
We think that's a bad place to be.
So trying to sort of, you know, cut your lifeboat free, maybe?
A little bit, yeah. And I think if you think about the television and radio, and you think about newspapers, they've all tried to capture magazines as a way of describing, a way of creating content and engaging with audiences. We need to take ownership of that back again.
Yeah. Andy, and your view is that does this become a market? You know, in many ways that we've seen, you know, fashion. I think even increasingly furniture design. We've touched on sort of architecture. I think also the way that a lot of Kiwi architects have made a name for themselves. Do you think we see the likes of Pilot and many things that are maybe bubbling away, on Max and elsewhere, also sort of going more global, do you think?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, Pilot, you know, we have pretty good distribution in Australia and plans to go further afield. And there are other magazines from New Zealand that are branching out globally, like Remix is in Europe and through New York and LA. So, I hope we continue that trend.
Excellent, gentlemen. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of this very special New Zealand, let's call it Auckland edition of The Stack. My guests today have been John Baker and Andy Pickering. Our producers were Don Trump, Adrian Craddock, and also Aisha Spears, who's been looking after me in studio here at Envy in Auckland. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the same time next Saturday, live from Sydney. And finally, a special thanks to our host, Envy Post Production, here in Auckland. But for now, for me, Tyler Brulé, it's goodbye from Auckland.